It's summertime, it's hot, it's hazy, and conventions are on. That's a recipe for trouble. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
It's very good to be with you again. Sorry we missed last week. We had some technical issues that we couldn't deal with and some time issues, so you got a rerun, but we're back live.
Well, you know, that's all right, Chuck, because I think that sometimes things that we talk about are not hemmed in by the time and circumstances in which they actually occur, but oftentimes are more meta themes on the larger issues of our society. So I think every once in a while running a rerun actually is probably a good, it's like taking a refresher course for education.
When we do a rerun, I try to run something that's relevant. In other words, I try to run something that is a kind of a fundamentals program or something that talks about some kind of issue. And we, that's what we did last week. We ran something that sort of, it's a clarification of you know, to try to keep everybody on track with what's happened in the past and what is we predict going forward. And I think if I remember right, we made some predictions in that program. So, that's where we are.
Now, you're not going to hold me to remembering what predictions we made in that program. I apologize.
Hey. You get copies of all the files when they come over, so you can download it and listen to it. Actually, you can go on the website and listen to it because there's one that's already up on the website.
Absolutely. Well, but you know what? The thing is, we've got an awful lot to talk about. Actually, there was an awful lot we could have talked about last week, including the failed effort by folks in the Mitt Romney camp to actually. And with the Virginia delegation of all things, not the Utah delegation, not the Michigan delegation, Chuck, but the Virginia delegation to the Republican National Convention, to challenge in federal court the rules of the Republican Party and the rules of the state party in Virginia about the fact that if a certain candidate has won the state, then the delegates from that state are bound to vote for that delegate. Or that candidate, excuse me, on the first ballot. There was a lawsuit that was brought in federal court mainly by folks who were in the Never Trump movement. Well, as we know, since we're recording this on Wednesday, and last night, Donald Trump officially became the nominee of the Republican Party for president in November, that they were pretty unsuccessful. Well, in part, we had dueling opinions from two different federal courts. One who said that the delegates had to stay following the rules of their state party, and another that said no, they're completely unbound. So, you know, obviously at this point, and with an issue that happened, I think on Monday during the convention, since the convention kicked off Sunday evening, Monday morning in Cleveland. There was an effort made by a number of folks in that Never Trump movement, which, hey, you know, more power to them, to try to get the rules amended in order to be able to be free from being bound for voting on the first ballot for the candidate who won in a winner-take-all proposition state, which we know that the vast majority of states are winner-take-all now. There are only a handful of them that do proportional anymore, and that's part of the reason why Donald Trump was so successful. Was not only was he winning winner-take-all states, but in proportional states, he was winning enough share of the proportion, oftentimes coming in first place, in order to build up enough delegate count promissories to get his opponents out of the race, all the way to the end. And I think it was, in April that John Kasich, who was the last opponent standing, dropped out of the race?
You know, it's interesting you say that, because I just heard a news report on SRN News, which is the Salem Radio News, the Salem Network. And the Salem Network said that Ted Cruz was the last one to pull out, and I'm like, I don't think so. It was John Kasich.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was Kasich. I think Cruz suspended his campaign while Kasich was still actively pursuing delegates in a number of states. So, yeah, Kasich was the last man standing before Donald Trump. Now, again, all this is now purely academic because, again, on Tuesday night, on the floor of the Republican National Convention, the delegates selected Donald Trump on the first ballot as their candidate. So that's what we've got. And Donald Trump, during this last week, I think on, well, it was known last Thursday. So even if we would have had a chance to record last week, we probably would have missed this one because we usually record on Wednesdays.
Yeah.
Donald Trump picked Governor Mike Pence of Indiana to be his running mate. So the ticket now is Trump-Pence for the Republican Party for the 2016 presidential election. Now, Mike Pence is an interesting character. He was a congressman, and then he went back and he served as governor of Indiana. Now I think he's in his second term. And, you know, Pence has been historically what one would have called a rock-ribbed conservative. You know, when he was in Congress, he was very conservative. And, he, you know, he's not a big fan of international trade deals or open borders or anything of that nature. But the one thing that gives social conservatives a little pause with Mike Pence, although you wouldn't tell it if you saw my Facebook feed from many of my social conservative friends, they were doing backflips over the idea that Mike Pence was going to be the VP nominee, as if that actually made a policy difference for what was going to happen in the Trump administration.
Yeah, and that's the problem with the way evangelicals think. First of all, they don't really deeply vet people. They take a look at, they're the kind of people that take a look at something that someone puts out that has a quote-unquote a scorecard, and they say, look, his score is really good. Well, very often what they don't realize is that those scorecards only go to very specific issues, and sometimes the votes on those issues aren't exactly what they look like to the people vetting those issues. So very often someone can appear conservative when in fact they're not really. Now, I'm not saying that about Pence. Pence has some other issues, but
yes.
Yeah, for the most part, he is that term rock ribbed conservative really doesn't mean much.
Not anymore.
It doesn't. No, it doesn't.
And honestly, the reason why Pence now has a question mark beside his conservative credentials is the fact that in Indiana here about a year and a half ago, the Indiana Assembly had passed a religious liberties bill.
Yes.
It was similar to RFRA that had been passed in 19 other states across the country, and that was the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. It's modeled on federal law that made sure that pastors and ministries and churches would be protected from being, you know, harassed, sued, brought into the machinery of government by homosexual activists. In other words, they would be free to exercise their faith under the terms of their conscience and their religious belief systems. And if that meant that they didn't recognize or want to participate in or acknowledge a homosexual pairing, they didn't have to. Now, this was all prior to the Obergefell decision that happened last July. This was like in the spring and kind of was a lead up to that. But what happened was when the Indiana legislature passed this measure, the governor was going to sign the measure. But all of a sudden, corporate America had a major hiccup with it because of how much they have been, let's say, groomed by the homosexual rights community, including the Human Rights Campaign and others, in order to have a knee-jerk reaction and say that you're being a bigot if you don't basically discriminate against people of faith in favor of those who are openly committing sin
right.
with the sodomy and the gay rights movement. I don't even like saying the word gay because it's just not true. But with that pressure from numerous companies, including, I think, HP and PayPal and others. I mean, the same list of ne'er-do-well companies that it did the same thing in North Carolina on the bathroom bill. They all threatened to not, you know, look at Indiana as a place to put a factory or to do business or to have their corporate headquarters, including some of the pharmaceutical companies. I think Eli Lilly was involved because they're headquartered there in Indiana. And Pence folded. He backed off, and the legislature redid the bill. And what they did was they changed this religious liberties bill, which, again, is modeled after a standing federal law that has been working well, and they changed it to a bill that basically said, well, okay, we'll give pastors and ministries protection, but at the same time, we're going to create this tension by handing gay, lesbian, the GLBTQI, whatever the alphabet soup is anymore of their acronyms.
Right. LMNOPQRSTUVWXYZ.
But gave them special rights in relations to a number of things, housing, employment, you know, things that right now there are already laws in place that protect people who are being discriminated or denied employment or housing for numerous reasons. I mean, if you've ever owned rental property, you know how hard it is to get rid of people who are breaking the law and not paying, you know, your rental property. So there are plenty of laws in place now, but you know, the homosexual rights movement wants to have a special carve out in these civil rights laws so that they can be used as clubs against people of faith, especially the church. And Pence and the Republican legislature in Indiana folded like a bad hand of cards against corporate pressure, and they put in this basically, you know, open season on pastors' law. You know, this whole balance. And of course, we've got a legislator here in Ohio who's trying to do the same thing, thinking, well, this will never get religious liberties protection without striking a balance. And so therefore, we got to have this. And again, the governor here in Ohio, John Kasich, has already said publicly when he was on the campaign trail and otherwise that he won't sign a religious protection bill into law unless it has protection provisions for the alphabet soup of the homosexual rights movement. And again, another reason why I'm kind of glad, A, he didn't win the nomination for president, and B, that we only have 2 years left to John Kasich and we have term limits in Ohio.
Well, Barry, this whole act, but this is a sidebar, this whole act of not going to the convention and throwing parties at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and all that stuff, every day that, I'll be quite honest, every day that John Kasich does not show up to the Republican National Convention, for which is in his own state, in his own party, he puts another nail in his political coffin. He wants to run for Senate real bad against Sherrod Brown.
Right.
It ain't going to happen.
You know, and earlier we had kind of speculated that Sherrod Brown might be on the short list for Hillary Clinton for vice president. And after further consideration of that, Chuck, I realized that that's not going to happen, because the problem is Sherrod Brown is a Democrat senator in a Republican governor's
state.
That's
right. They don't want to remove him from the Senate because it puts him one more down.
It's a net loss of two, because
yes,
they'd lose one Democrat
and gain one Republican.
Senate, and it'd gain a Republican vote in the Senate, and that math doesn't work for the Democratic Party.
Well, see, I wouldn't put it past John Kasich, too, to appoint himself.
Oh, well, you know, the assumption would be that he would appoint himself. Who's he going to appoint? Josh Mandel? He's had a public firefight with Mandel for a while now over Mandel's support of Marco Rubio.
Yeah, that's because basically Mandel is actually conservative and Kasich is not.
Oh, well, you know, there's a major surprise for you. But anyhow, enough with John Kasich, and hopefully we can just weather the next 2 years and be done with this nightmare.
Yes.
You know, we're dealing with Donald Trump right now as the nominee, and I'm sure a lot of people, you know, the Mitt Romneys of the world, the Jeb Bushes of the world, are trying to figure out if they can really swallow hard and vote for Hillary Clinton. And believe you me, Chuck, I'm guessing that a number of them will.
Okay, hold on. You and I both worked for the Blackwell campaign in 2006.
Absolutely.
We know what it's really like when it's a GOPE candidate like John McCain or Bob Dole or Mitt Romney. We have to fall in line or we're disloyal. We're upsetting the apple cart. A vote for a third party candidate is a vote for Barack Obama or Clinton or name somebody. And yet when it's up to somebody who's an outsider, and I'm not saying this as a big fan of Trump, but someone who's outside the party elite apparatus, all of a sudden it's all A-okay for them to go not only vote for but endorse the other side, as happened right. here in the 2006 campaign against Blackwell. People came out, and Republican Party bigwigs came out in support of Ted Strickland.
Ted Strickland. They actually formed an actual organization that raised money and did, you know, support for Strickland, called Republicans for Strickland. And it was people like former State Senator Gary Suodolnik. You know, there were a number of other ones. Rocky Saxby, who's a major lobbyist and player in Columbus, an attorney. Numerous noted establishment Republicans in 2006 went over and supported Ted Strickland for governor. Now, these are the same people, Chuck, who are now, Ted Strickland was such a great choice for governor, but they don't want him for U.S. Senate, so they're all backing Rob Portman.
Well, that's because Portman's a liberal.
And part of the GOP establishment.
And part of the GOP establishment. So that's kind of my whole point. GOPE and liberal are virtually the same thing.
Are virtually synonymous. That's right. Well, so, you know, so here's the situation now. You know, we've got this situation. We're up in Cleveland, Ohio, John Kasich's home state. He's running away, you know, and making all these things. And, of course, his personal enforcer, Matt Borges, who is the state Republican Party chairman, when Trump's campaign manager, Paul Manafort, said something about how, you know, Kasich is now irrelevant and he's the past of the party, et cetera, Borges' response publicly, well, Manafort's got a lot to learn. Now let me paint this picture. Matt Borges has probably been around Republican Party politics maybe for 20 years, okay? I think he's maybe my age, maybe a little younger. He's been actively in Republican Party politics, and of course then that includes he worked on staff, and then he went out and he did lobbying, and he worked for a law firm, and then he represented such great groups like Equality Ohio, the gay rights group. You know, so you know, his bona fides and pedigrees for John Kasich's team is, you know, well earned. So against Paul Manafort, who's been around since the Goldwater campaign, advising and working with candidates of all stripes up and down the Republican ticket. Who do you think has got a lot to learn, Chuck? Is it Paul Manafort,
yeah,
who's actually backing the nominee, or is it Matt Borges, who's backing the lame duck limping out while his state's economy is starting to burn, governor?
Yeah, three guesses. It's the latter.
Yeah, guess what? And I say that thing about having our state's economy is ready to burn. There was some articles during this last week that we weren't on live that talked about how we got a little problem, Chuck, because revenues aren't coming in like they expected, and projections are, with the Medicaid expansion now, right now they're touting that, oh, we're under our projections for Medicaid. Ah, let's not kid ourselves, folks. It's January of next year when the federal government stops paying 100% of the Medicaid expansion.
Bingo.
Costs.
Bingo. As we predicted, of course, the free money only lasts for a limited amount of time. Then all of a sudden the money isn't free anymore.
Exactly. Then you're certainly dealing with other people's money less. And the point is that Medicaid expansion just keeps going. They keep pushing it. And right now they're projecting at least a $1.6 billion budget hole for the next fiscal budget in Ohio. That's early predictions, Chuck. Mainly based on the fact that revenues are not coming in like they expected. And expenditures are, especially Medicaid, they had more people enroll, like by a tune of 40% more people enroll in Medicaid than they expected. How do you miss a prediction with the modeling and the budgetary forecasting and everything that they've got at their fingertips from the Office of Budget and Management in Ohio? The Office of Health Transformation, which is the Medicaid office, run by people who should know what they're doing. How in the world did they miss a prediction of enrollments for Medicaid by 40%?
Because they cooked the books to start.
Yeah, okay, that may very well be the case, and I'm not the the accountant or the analyst who can actually like peg that down and say, yeah, right there it is. I do believe that as our state treasurer, Josh Mandel, who we mentioned a little bit earlier, has the state checkbook online, I suppose we could go and take a look and Google that up on the treasurer's website, and you type in Medicaid and see just exactly what our expenditures are looking like and where they're going to, because they put every invoice that's billed and paid for by the state government up on that checkbook. It's one of the great things. Ohio does have some transparency. It's just the vast majority of the folks, the citizens in Ohio, don't know it's there. And even if they find it, sometimes not sure how to use it. But really, you know, you can go in there, because that's how we figured out Planned Parenthood back when we were doing the bill regarding some of the funds, was still pulling in over $1.3 million a year from the state when some folks in the pro-life movement were saying that we've defunded Planned Parenthood already. You know, it's like, nah, the numbers actually don't lie. They may be cooked sometimes, but ultimately, you know, there comes a reckoning. And what was the old saying that I think is attributed to Lincoln, but it's probably by somebody else? It says, no man has a good enough memory to be a successful liar. Well, when you're dealing with hard numbers and budgets that have to come and things that have to come due and payments that have to be made, pretty soon there comes a reckoning point where the expenditures are greater than the revenues. And then you have to deal with the hard facts of maybe you just didn't know what you were doing in the first place, or you didn't care. Gee, that sounds like a familiar note harkening back to the federal budget, doesn't it?
Yeah, sure does. Sure does, Barry. I mean, look, the budgetary process has become so complex. And for instance, you think about it, what comes out? It comes out as an omnibus bill. Instead of things being done piecemeal like they should be. And what happens to it? Nobody can read that, Barry. Nobody can take a 1,000-page document and read it. How long does it take you to read a 1,000-page book on history, say?
Depending on what era of history, and if I'm really, really liking it, and if the author is a really, really engaging author, it still probably takes me 3 or 4 weeks.
Exactly, because let's face it, who's got the time to sit and absorb in one sitting? Now, we both know of people who were reading one book a day, and they weren't thin little books. They were big, heavy tomes on history and philosophy and government and the Bible and all kinds of things, theology. But that takes a very special kind of mind. And someone with a lot of time on their hands to be able to do that. You know, someone who's a professional researcher might be able to do that. You and I are not. You're closer than I am because you're a professional lobbyist, which means you have to be able to do quick research.
Yes.
I tend to be more deliberate. I read stuff and I think about it and I kind of hash it over and I'll read something else. It'll take me someplace else and then I'll read about it and then I'll hash that over and go back to the first thing. I tend to be kind of slow in my research. I know you have to be fast because you have to have stuff at your fingertips at a given time. So there's different kinds of ways of doing that. So yeah, that's the problem with the budget process. Nobody can read that kind of document in a sitting. Or even you have to break it up into pieces. And if you've got enough staff, okay, give me a staff summary of your section. And then you read the staff summaries.
Right. And the problem is sometimes you still don't understand what the driving motivation is behind making changes in certain sections of law until after they're made. And you see exactly, oh, that was their end game. Sometimes you can do some prediction on that and kind of figure it out. But oftentimes it's tied up in the minutiae of the bill. It's like, well, why are they shifting money from this pot to this pot? Oh, now I see what they were doing. This benefits this contributor over here. And yes, ladies and gentlemen, that does happen. The budget line items are created and disappear based oftentimes upon who's doing the most lobbying. Now, am I saying that they're doing something illegal? Well, no, I'm not saying it. Are they doing something illegal? Probably so. If they're directing state resources to certain entities because of receiving some kind of remuneration from them in the form of campaign contributions, yeah, that's illegal. Does it happen? Yeah, it still happens. But, you know, that's the whole thing, Chuck, though. You know, we're getting into a situation in Ohio where the pay for the piper is about to come due. John Kasich and his faux compassionate conservatism with the we must, you know, if you don't expand Medicaid, then, you know, you hate Jesus and, you know, you're going to be talking to St. Peter and he's going to give you a one-way ticket to hell. Isn't going to fly, you know, because the harsh realities of the thing is that when you offer an entitlement to people, they're going to take it, especially if they don't think they have to pay for it. And you can only, as Margaret Thatcher once said, socialism only works until you run out of other people's money. And in Ohio with Medicaid is going to run out of other people's money here pretty soon. So are many other states as the federal government comes back. Now, the question is, hey, what does a Donald Trump administration or even a Hillary Clinton administration do with the Medicaid expansion money? I mean, do they turn around and say, well, you know what? We think this is so important that the federal government's going to pay for it also. You know, that whole thing about you guys having to take up a portion of it in January. No, we're going to waive that and we're going to keep paying for it. Well, Chuck, that's still a problem because whose money is it? Whose money is paying for it? The federal government doesn't have money. They have basically confiscated our money.
Right.
That's the money you could use for your own family's health care. You could use for giving to tithe agencies or to churches or relief efforts. That's money you could be investing to create businesses that would hire employees who then could have health coverage under an employee plan. But the federal government and even our state government thinks that they know better. And so therefore, because so many people won't do that, or because so many people now can't afford to take those kind of risks because of government taxation, therefore government's going to step in and take over for us. And they're going to do the job so much better, aren't they, Chuck?
Barry, anytime someone uses a crisis to attempt to increase federal power, your red flag should all go up. Okay, you've just outlined the reason why the founders, when they wrote the Constitution, the constitutional authors forbade the federal government from doing direct taxation.
Yes.
Now, people don't understand what that means. What does a direct tax mean? That means the federal government was not permitted to tax the people directly. What they had to do was go to the states and say, this is your quota. This is what you owe for federal services. And the way that was done was through the budgetary process. In other words, through the House of Representatives to start and the Senate to finish. And you have to remember that before 1913, senators were chosen as the state government representative in the federal government. So in other words, they were mostly chosen by state legislatures or by any method the state legislature chose to have senators chosen by, which is why some senators were elected by popular vote even when that was in place. Now, why does that matter? Well, it matters because what would not happen under that system was the federal government would come in and say, well, we need $270 billion more than you're giving us. That simply couldn't be done because the state legislatures would look at it and the people of the states would look at it and say, no, we're not giving you that much money. Here's how much we'll give you. And that happened a lot before direct taxation.
Yes, it did.
Now that we have direct taxation, the federal government simply picks your pocket at will. My wife and I were talking in the car today, and I said, do you understand what now they're talking now about, you know, Social Security isn't going to be able to pay full benefits after, I forget when it is, 2030 or something. And I said, oh, perfect. Right around the time I'm actually thinking about retiring, if I get to retire at all. And that I said, you know what that means, honey? And she said, no. And I said, it means another Social Security income or a Social Security tax increase or that's what they're going to try out. Do you know what the Social Security tax is right now?
You mean percentage-wise?
Yeah.
Probably about 17%.
I think it's 12.5%.
Oh, okay, so it's a little bit less than I expected. Hey, I hope that no agency official heard me utter that number and thought, hey, that's a great idea.
Okay, I do withholding every week. I looked at it. I actually withhold more Social Security now than I do income tax.
Wow.
Federal withholding. That's a problem. That's a problem because...
Yes, it is.
We're reaching a point where, because people don't see... You know, we have adopted a euphemism in this country, and that is we say, well, I'm getting this much money back from the federal government. Well, a refund check, just think about what you could have done had you been able to keep that money in your paycheck rather than binge spending it once a year. We talk about income tax refunds as if, oh, it's free money. No, it's not. It's money that belonged to you in the first place, and the federal government got to keep it interest-free for a year. We have to stop thinking like that. We have to stop thinking it goes along with the mindset that all money is the federal government's money, and the federal government lets you keep a certain portion of it. No, all money is your money, and you let the federal government have some of it.
Exactly.
In return for certain services. Now, the fact is the government performing the services it was originally designed to perform? And the answer is, well, no, it's not. In fact, it's refusing to perform services it was originally designed to do, and that is protect the borders, defense, diplomacy, and trade. It refuses to engage in a reasonable diplomacy, as we can see with the whole Benghazi mess, which is part of the reason, you know, Hillary Clinton sat by and did nothing while ambassadors were murdered. Chris Matthews got very upset. He said that was a lie that's been disproven. And I'm like, it has no such thing. Hillary Clinton knew that there was a problem and had known for days that there was going to be a problem and did nothing. The ambassador, who was a big Obama supporter, that's basically how you get to be appointed an ambassador rather than being someone who's qualified for the job, begged and pleaded for help. Please send the Marines, send somebody here. And nobody came. And the reason nobody came is because the president did nothing, and he did not require his Secretary of State to do anything. And, you know, Barry, we often hear things about executive orders. The president's going to do this by executive order, that by executive order. And the fact is, that's what the executive order is for. It's to force secretaries of the given departments and department heads to do the job that they've been appointed to do. In other words, the president can order a head of a department to do a job that he or she refuses to do. That's the point of the executive order, and that's what they were used for the first significant portion of the republic. I'm not going to say the first half, because that's not true. They quickly Theodore Roosevelt was a master of using the executive order well beyond to simply seize power from Congress. But we're in bad condition here because A, we don't know how the government's supposed to work. B, we don't know how much they really spend. And C, we look the other way while they increase taxes to do stuff like continue Social Security benefits when everybody knew it was a Ponzi scheme to start with and that eventually it would run out of money. So what do we do about it?
Well, you know, the only thing we can do about it is start being smarter with our vote. But hey, you know, as I'm seeing right now, a lot of people are like, oh, well, you know, we can't have Hillary in there. So therefore, oh, well, since Donald Trump had Mike Pence, then I guess I can vote for him. I can swallow hard and vote for Donald Trump. And we talked about this on the last program we had on air. And that was the idea that if you're a follower of Christ and you claim the name of Christ, and you turn around and say, I'm going to vote for Donald Trump because Hillary's, you know, evil, or as Ben Carson kind of put it, Hillary is tied to Satan. I think it is his speech the other night. He was, there were some references in there that tied that a little tighter. And again, that's all fodder for evangelicals so that they can feel better about voting for Donald Trump. You're actually denying your faith, because we're not called to vote for evil or the lesser of two evils or to do what we can. We're called to vote. We're called to exercise a duty and a responsibility and have a proper response before God. It isn't like God left this whole area, you know, up to us. He has standards in his word for the type of people that we're supposed to put in office over us. I mean, Romans 13, they're ministers of God. Would you be a member of a church that Donald Trump was the pastor at? Just ask yourself that, ladies and gentlemen. And if you can honestly say yes, well, I don't know what to say, but except the fact that maybe you need to look at your Bible a little bit more closely and you need to pray more.
Yeah.
Of course, everybody's trotting out the whole thing. I saw this on my Facebook feeds from people who honestly should know better.
We're not electing the pastor in chief.
We're not electing the pastor in chief. Oh, he's not. We can't have perfection. Blah, blah, blah. The only perfect man, they killed him. And I'm thinking to myself, yeah, those are all sound wonderful for, you know, shallow excuses. But if you're going to be serious about your faith, you got to dive into the scriptures, and the scriptures are replete with prohibitions against doing something actively in sin. Sorry, I'm getting a little hot about this.
Yes.
But you know what? This is ridiculous. Oh, well, but we can't. This guy, you can't vote for the third parties because, oh, you're throwing away your vote. No, you're throwing away your vote if you're voting for somebody knowing full well what they really are and expecting them to have this miraculous change of holiness and righteousness for you when they assume office on the 20th of January. That really is, I think, Chuck, problematic.
Yes, it is.
I'll be nice. It's problematic.
And probably in a close second place is someone who says, well, he said all the right words and therefore he's okay.
As if a ritual and tradition and mouthing the right homily makes everything work.
Well, it's like primary Eve conversions to pro-life position.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I've seen a few of those too. Yeah.
Well, some of them like Donald Trump.
Oh yeah, exactly. Well, and there you go again. So now, granted, they're smart because if you've seen the lineup of people they've rolled in to speak at the RNC, it really is. I mean, it's like Manafort and company kind of understood. We really have to mainly roll in people that are going to keep the grassroots the other grassroots, i.e. the non-Trump grassroots, engaged, or at least to convince them to come over and stay on board the ship with us as we sail. You know, you've had Ben Carson speaking. You've had pastor. Well, they had a blow up with one pastor who basically is a prosperity gospel guy and who basically likened that, you know, we have to defeat the great Satan, Hillary Clinton, and Donald Trump's God's man for the hour, and he's anointed, and because he's successful, then that means that he's holy. And I'm roughly paraphrasing what this pastor
right.
said, but it really was completely distasteful to see what this pastor did.
Yes, exactly. That's just...
But anyhow, but you know what, Chuck? The one thing that we don't have so much of, and yes, there's a little bit of it, and that is the protests that were supposed to be Chicago 68 kind of thing in the Republican, you know, convention in Cleveland. And even, you know, Cleveland police, you know, they beefed up. They spent extra millions of dollars for equipment security. You have law enforcement personnel that have come in from all over the country. You know, you've got state patrols, Cleveland police, sheriffs, everybody else, all in the, you know, potential of there being something completely distasteful around the convention. And really, it's by and large, it hasn't happened because there has been a solid police presence. Now, yesterday, I guess you had some dust ups when you had And you talk about a toxic combination or a flammable mix here. When you had the Ku Klux Klan, Black Lives Matter,
yes,
and the Westboro Baptist Church members all in the same area yesterday, and I guess it got heated to the point that someone, or maybe multiple someones from one or more or all of the groups, started throwing urine at each other. Okay, I don't want to know. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's disgusting. But if that is the biggest thing that's going to happen, is you're going to have the KKK and Black Lives Matter and the loonies from Westboro Baptist all in the same little zone, and they're all the worst things you're going to do is yell at each other and
throw urine at each other, throw
a potty tantrum. I guess, yeah, I'll say it that way. Then you know what? Count your blessings, because that could be an awful lot worse.
It could be an awful lot worse. Now, there have been protesters that showed up, obviously very provocatively, armed with AR-15s. Whether they were actually loaded or not, nobody knows. But basically, it was supposed to intimidate some of the convention goers, and basically no one was intimidated. So they went home.
Yeah, they all
Everybody kind of said, yeah, I got one of those too. I didn't bring mine. But there was, you know, they're talking about open carry. There's a lot of open carry and that kind of thing. Well, guess what? Ohio, if you got a permit, Ohio's an open carry state. You can wear one.
That's right.
Now, you can't wear, for instance, if I tried to wear mine into the Rife building, they'd stop me. They wouldn't let me.
Yeah,
they wouldn't let me do that.
It's a posted building. Yeah, it's not going to happen. Yeah.
But there are places. Yeah, I mean, I can walk around with one on my hip if I want to. And some businesses will tell me to get out, and that's well within their rights, although they're stupid.
Yeah, well, that's true. Now, I think, seriously, next week is the Democratic National Convention, the DNC, in Philadelphia, and I don't think they're going to get off quite so easy.
I don't think so either.
Although we've had in the last week Bernie Sanders officially suspend his campaign and officially endorse Hillary Clinton. Yeah, kind of in a, yeah, I endorse her, but let me go talk to you about what I believe in kind of way. But point is, if the hope for the Clinton camp was that Bernie supporters would be like, oh, okay, our leader has embraced her, so that we must embrace her too, and everybody's going to go home and feel better about themselves and work together. Ain't happening.
Not happening, baby.
there was a little prelude taste of that happened this last week, as another convention took place in St. Louis, Missouri. It's called the Netroots Convention. Now, the Netroots Convention is a convention that has sprung up around liberal bloggers who, you know, keep the Clinton machinery and the Democratic talking points alive out there and savage the right and do all this fun stuff. But these are all the progressives, Chuck. These are the ones who are smarter than everybody. And so Netroots was having their convention this last week, and their problem was that Bernie, and this was right around the time Bernie Sanders dropped out and announced his support for Hillary Clinton. And, you know, Hillary's really got a problem with these Netroot folks, the Bernie Sanders voters who walked out of the Netroots convention. And, Chuck, it's so sad because they were walking out of a panel called Translating Millennial Votes into Power. So they've decided that they don't need somebody to tell them how to do it. They're just going to go out and do it themselves. And so they have basically walked out of this convention, and they're working with another group. And this one should sound familiar to some people. It's called Hands Up United. This was the group that formed after the shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. And basically what they have said now, and this, the Hands Up United group and the Bernie Sanders protesters, progressives who walked out of this Netroots convention last week, are basically said that, you know, these mainly white delegates to the Netroots convention, these bloggers, are, quote, occupiers in the, quote, disunited states of America. They're occupiers, Chuck. So in other words, if you're white, even if you're a liberal progressive, you aren't legitimate. You're an occupier. That's got to send some very deep shockwaves of fear down the spines of Hillary Clinton and her political advisors.
I would think so. This is very close to the whole 1968 Eugene McCarthy, you know, the alternate convention stuff, you know, where, mm-hmm. And Barry, this is so much like 1968. And unfortunately, it takes guys about my age to remember that.
It does, my age, Chuck, and above. And the key is there's also going to be a situation where a group called Democracy Spring is actually planning sit-ins and mass arrests in Philadelphia at the DNC next week. So what little bit's happening at the RNC with protesters is going to be magnified a dozen times at the DNC.
Yeah. Yeah. And in fact, okay, here's another way we're like 1968 again. Now, we haven't been through so much through the long, hot summer stuff like we were in 1967 and 68, you know, with rioting and cities burning and that kind of thing, although we have had a different form of it in this cop killing and tensions running high between the police and different communities. And we've got an immigration problem that we didn't have in 1968. So things are very different, but they're also very much the same. And what we're basically seeing is, what's the Republican National Convention about? One of the main themes, law and order. Law and order, the law and order candidate in 1968 was?
Hubert Humphrey.
No, yeah, wrong. And wrong, and you know better. It was Richard M. Nixon.
Richard Nixon, that's right.
Basically, people who understood conservatism were asked to swallow hard and accept Richard Nixon because he was going to bring law and order back. Now, the bottom line is that actually kind of happened. Gary DeMar does an excellent talk, and he says, does anyone know when the 70s ended? And he asks this question rhetorically, and he gives three things that showed that the 70s were over, and I can remember two of them. One thing was the Kent State protests and the four, I always laugh, the four students. These guys, they may have been students, but they weren't students at Kent State. I think one was. Most of them were professional bust-in protesters who were there to protest the Vietnam War. Another thing was the... believe it or not, was the stabbing at the Altamont Raceway at a Rolling Stones concert that was being, the Rolling Stones had basically hired the Hells Angels as security.
Right.
Boy, that was a good move. Who basically, a guy got lit out of his brain on LSD or something, and the Hells Angels stabbed him to death right there in front of everybody. And there was another incident. But basically, he said that brought an end to the 70s. You had the Vietnam War came to an end. I mean, we withdrew in 1973. That's what a lot of the violence was purportedly about. And, of course, the Saigon fell in 1975. In fact, the spring of the year, April of 1975, and I graduated from high school in June of 1975. So... people have often asked me, well, why didn't you serve in Vietnam? I said, well, I would have had to go when I was 16 to be able to get there. And frankly, I didn't want to go. that being said, this is Richard Nixon sort of did bring law and order to the country. But how did he do it? Well, he ended the war for one thing, but he also empowered a lot of the federal officers to start doing some things that I think personally are extra constitutional. You know, the problem with the Constitution is it can also be used as a protective screen behind which you do things, and that's part of the Saul Alinsky training.
Yes,
you hide behind the Constitution. You get activist judges who say it means something that it doesn't. And then you hide behind those rulings, you know, with free speech and that kind of thing. In the meantime, the same people are the people who are running universities where someone controversial speaks, and they say, "Well, you can have a free speech zone here. This 200 square feet in the back of this parking lot, six blocks away from the event, that's your free speech zone." Well, they didn't have to deal with free speech zones when they were doing the same thing when they were in college. But that's different now because we're now in control. That's the mindset. So this now you ask yourself, what's the Democratic National Committee? What is their basically their theme? They're open borders. They're all about open borders. They're all about Black Lives Matter, and they're all about more federal power. Well, ostensibly, the Republicans aren't for more federal power. Donald Trump has at least been making the right noises about, at least in some degree, about reining in the federal government. And so that's what you're dealing with, the contrast you're dealing with, and it's the same kind of contrast you were dealing with in 1968. It's very similar. Yes, well, it's not a carbon copy, no, but is it very similar? Yeah, very, very similar.
Well, to the point that, you know, Hillary Clinton's got herself a passel of problems here, because not only are the Netroots folks pretty upset, she's got to make a pick here real soon of who's going to be her vice presidential candidate. And that's going to be tough because, you know, right now she's got, I think, really the triangulations in three different ways in the Democratic Party. You know, first of all, she has to appease the what we would call the establishment wing of the Democratic Party, which is her wing, the Clinton wing, and they want their insiders. That's the reason why the name of Tim Kaine, who's the governor of Virginia, has floated out there.
Exactly.
Tim Kaine is one of the consummate Clinton insiders. However, big problem with Tim Kaine is he wouldn't meet the demographic qualifications of the other two legs of this precariously balanced stool that Hillary Clinton's trying to stand on. One leg, the other leg is the Black Lives Matter movement, Chuck, and other ethnically based positions, whether it's La Raza, Black Lives Matter, this Hands Up movement, whomever it is, the identity politics progressive wing of the party, who by and large went with Bernie Sanders during the primary. And that's the reason why this Netroots conference was such a big tell on what might be happening in the Clinton camp prior to going into Philadelphia next week, is they know they have to appease them. And a guy like Tim Kaine is not going to be a pick that's going to be celebrated or even accepted by this progressive wing, identity wing of the party, because he's an insider, and you know the Trans-Pacific Partnership stuff and everything else that goes along with that. And then you have that third wing of the party, which are the and again the other two wings kind of somewhat these are all interlocking portions. They're not like they're exactly fighting against each other completely. So let's not
right.
You know, this isn't like the establishment GOP and the hardcore social conservatives who probably won't see eye to eye until one of them scares the other one into voting for who they want. But the third wing of that Democratic stool is the homosexual rights movement. And they're not going to be satisfied for anything less than having someone who they feel represents them, you know, more directly. Now, I'm not saying that, you know, Hillary's going to pick somebody who's openly homosexual for her vice presidential pick, but they're not going to be happy with a Tim Kaine either. You know, they're more along the lines of looking at somebody much more progressive like Elizabeth Warren.
Now, exactly.
And Elizabeth Warren gives you a couple of chits, because the identity progressive Bernie Sanders supporters like Warren as well. But your problem is, if you're Hillary Clinton, how are you going to run with two women on the ticket and still hope to capture enough of the Midwestern and Southern votes of men, especially, in order to come home in November with the nomination? I'm not sure it's possible. You know, Trump made a safe choice in one sense, because he could have picked somebody like a Joni Ernst out of Iowa, you know, for gender balance on the ticket in the Republican primary. But he picked Mike Pence for ideological balance, because you know, Trump knows he's going to be, he's reaching out to the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, the Tea Party folks who are not necessarily, you know, super religious. And he's got Pence to reach out to the religious conservatives of the party and, to some extent, you know, the establishment wing of the party, even though Pence is not necessarily what I would consider hardcore establishment either. But Hillary's got a real problem on her hands, Chuck. I mean, does she pick Elizabeth Warren and create a situation on her ticket? Does she pick a Tim Kaine and create a situation on her ticket? Does she pick some other progressive liberal, maybe a Western or a West Coast candidate for her vice presidential candidates? Sort of like a Villaraigosa, who was the mayor of Los Angeles, right, who could bring in Hispanic votes and could and might even impress the progressives enough to keep them on board. A lot's going to come out of this, but, you know, Hillary, you know, one of the things she's already doing for the progressives is that after the Netroots conference, she addressed, I think, the last day of the Netroots conference. And one of the things that she promised them was in her first, you know, night, I think it was 30 days in office of a Clinton presidency, that she would introduce a constitutional amendment. Okay, first of all, Chuck, where in the Constitution does it allow a president to introduce a constitutional amendment?
Well, how about Article 9? Oh, wait.
Okay.
There isn't any such thing.
There isn't an Article 9 in the Constitution.
Right. In the Bill of Rights, yes, but that's not where it is.
Right, right. So you know, she's throwing out sops to the progressives to try to get the Bernie Sanders folks back on board with her, which is probably signaling that she's going to, she thinks she can, if just like Bernie promised, if she can promise them enough goodies, then they will ignore what she's really doing, which is most likely picking a Tim Kaine, a Clinton consummate insider, as her vice presidential candidate. Which means, really, honestly, Chuck, unless you see a mass exodus in the Republican Party of establishment Republicans refusing to vote for Trump or actively campaigning for Hillary, I'm going to make a rough prediction right now that I think Trump will probably be our next president.
Yeah, there are this is the same problem in 1968. How do you weld the various radical fractions of the party together? And the fact is that, yes, some in the Republican Party establishment will jump ship and go over to Hillary because they consider her a quote-unquote moderate, even though her record shows that she's an ultra-liberal. How do you weld those together with a vice presidential pick? You brought up the Hispanic vote. The Democratic Party already has that.
Sure. And the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce, which was a group that Donald Trump was pursuing quite actively, even though he had made a number of comments early on in the campaign that had Hispanics upset at him, basically endorsed Hillary Clinton this week during the GOP convention, kind of as a stick in the eye to Donald Trump.
Right. And you're almost for sure you're not going to see, as you and I think we talked about this off air, maybe, or maybe we did on air. You're not going to see somebody like a Sherrod Brown get picked, because that would be a net 2-seat loss in the Senate.
Right.
Because Kasich would probably appoint himself to take that seat. So he'd have a leg up to run and be defeated.
Now, the other side of that coin, though, another name in the Democratic universe did pop up that could very well help Hillary almost triangulate this whole thing. It may not completely suit the identity politics progressives, and it may not completely suit the homosexual rights folks, and it may not completely suit the Clinton establishment insiders, but the name of Richard Cordray, the former Ohio Attorney General, who is now the head of the Consumer Protection Division in the Obama administration, has been floated out there much more. Now, Cordray is a progressive dream in one sense. He's not nearly the rock star Sherrod Brown is to the progressives, but he's got the chops. He's young. He's got the chops. He brings balance to the ticket. He helps them to really, you know, try to bring it home in Ohio, because of his, you know, past popularity in Ohio. He could very well be a safe pick for Hillary Clinton.
Well, we're going to have to leave it at that because we're out of time. I will say that I think it's too much a wonks pick. Those are the only people who really know who he is.
Yeah.
No name recognition. That being said, we are out of time. And you know what we think. We want to know what you think. www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And a copy of this will eventually be up on the website where you can listen to it again. And with that being said, I ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.